This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week. On the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR, here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Good afternoon. Our guest this afternoon is one of the most interesting figures in the state of Arizona. Former state minority leader most of the time, occasionally majority leader, back in the, I think he just told me, the late 1980s, briefly was majority leader for 4 years. And a lifelong, and I say this with great affection, I think, lifelong troublemaker. In the spirit of Washington, Jefferson, Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, and others, all folks who at one time or another threatened the existing order. First impressions can sometimes be deceiving. I don't know if you remember, Alfredo, the first time we met was in an interesting place, and I figured this was the sort of place you hung out in. You were hiring us. You had a consulting firm at the time. And we met in the boardroom of the then Phelps Dodge Corporation. And I figured this is the kind of place you came from. This is a conference room now, Freeport MacMoran, about the size of a half a football field, with mahogany and leather. And I figured, well, this is where you came from. I think I was probably wrong in that respect.
I suspect you were.
tell us about that, because you've written a most interesting book, To Sin Against Hope, which is in part autobiographical. And tell us about the book and tell us about your story.
Well, To Sin Against Hope is the title is taken from a phrase from the Latin American historian and writer and activist Eduardo Galeano, who said that all sins are forgivable, save one, to sin against hope. The book is a memoir. It in effect uses the history of my family in this country, which begins generations ago. On my father's side, to tell the story of Mexicans in the United States since 1848, that is the, and particularly in Arizona, Mexicans in the United States and Arizona, to tell the story of my own family and how it evolved over that period of time, and also to weave in through that the history of immigration policy in this country. The last two chapters are really devoted to immigration policy in this country. So all of that is woven together into what one reviewer called a hodgepodge, but most reviewers have thought it was all right. The book is about to go into its second edition, and we expect a paperback copy in November.
And tell us a little bit about the family history. How many generations do you go back?
Well, the family history, as far as we've traced it, begins in 1870 or so, when my great 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 grandmother arrived in Clifton, Morenci, in an ox cart, and that's in an ox cart with two adult children, two adult sons, to set up a business and. In Clifton, Arizona. And Clifton, of course, was a mining
town
and a boom town at the time. Her name was Luna, not Gutierrez. And that's where sort of the traceable history begins. Her husband, whose last name was Samudio, he was there at the time. We've really been unable to trace any further than that. But clearly he had arrived somewhere around 1850 or so, at least to Clifton. How long he'd been in the Northern Territories or the United States of America post-1848 is really unknown to us. But that's where the family history begins. And for the first few generations, it's inextricably tied to two things. One is mining towns. And the other is unions. My great-grandfather was a union organizer in Clifton. My father was a member of both of the mine mill, which was considered at the time the Communist Union, and of the steelworkers. The steelworkers ultimately took over the membership of the mine mill. But the mine mill was the radical union of the time. But the mine mill was much more than that. It was the civil rights organization of Mexicans in the Southwest of the United States. And I'll give you an example of that. At the time, and we're talking, and I'll go through this the history of this. But at the time, Mexicans were paid a dollar less in most of the copper mining area. A dollar less than what was then called white people. It didn't matter if the white people had just arrived from Ireland or England or wherever in Europe, they would be paid a dollar more than any Mexican. And it didn't matter if the Mexicans had been here since 1848. The fact was that it was strictly adhered to discrimination that was imposed by all of the mines at the time. It was mine mill that took on that fight and ultimately won that fight. But the fight went on for years. The fight went on for years.
Roughly what period?
The first victory happened during World War II when mine mill first was termed the Communist Union because it said, it simply announced that if Mexicans weren't paid an equal wage, they would go on strike. Copper was an absolutely necessary commodity for the war. And so President Roosevelt's War Relations Board actually intervened in the mines in Miami, Arizona, and Clifton, et cetera, to force equal pay. But after the war...
Probably justified by war effort.
Exactly. But after the war, the mines reverted to old tricks. Look, it was not until 1963 that the actual... lawsuits that went on during the mine mill period were finally settled with Phelps Dodge and with some of the other mining corporations. So it was a very long battle. Segregation. The communities were absolutely segregated. Everything, swimming pool, the famous story that Mexicans were allowed in the swimming pool on Sundays is absolutely true because the pool was drained Sunday night, and we weren't allowed back till the next Sunday afternoon.
Well, we want to dig more into your book, sir, To Sin Against Hope. Alfredo Gutierrez is our guest. When we come back, we want to get into local politics, talk about yesteryear when it actually worked. Thanks for being with us. This is The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are talking Arizona history with Alfredo Gutierrez, and I think you got us into, the draining of swimming pools. That went into the 60s?
That ended in the early 50s, as did segregated schools. But the point I was making was that unions played a major role in Arizona's history, an important one, particularly to Mexicans. And that went on for another 20, 30 years, frankly, until the strike in Morenci under Governor Bruce Babbitt that brought the union to its knees. Governor Babbitt, the liberal governor, is probably most responsible for killing labor in this state.
And by that point, it's late 70s.
By that time, yes, that's correct.
I remember that was big, and I had just gotten here late 70s.
Yes, so. That's correct. It was the largest mobilization of the National Guard and the Department of Public Safety and local police officers, in a sense, to break a strike. Not in a sense, to literally break a strike, ordered by the liberal Democratic governor who was seeking the presidency, which explains a great deal of why he didn't go very far, by the way. Well, but the book goes on to the present time and really to the current debate in the Obama administration over immigration policy in this country.
What's your take on that?
Well, I think...
You've taken real exception to Obama's immigration policies.
Obama's immigration policy, from my point of view, I think from the point of view of the immigrant community, are historically the worst, that is the most oppressive, that have ever been imposed upon us in this country.
That's going to jar many people.
It is going to jar many people.
He's been attacked from the right as being soft on immigration.
Well, and the right The right has attacked him on every front, immigration being one of those fronts. But the facts are pretty clear. He has deported more people than any other administration in the history of this country. He has devastated more families than anyone else in the history of this country. He has buckled under pressure, for example, and allowed certain exemptions from deportations, students, for example. Mm-hmm. He's allowed that to take place. But that's because of intense and massive pressure.
And it is my understanding that while the number of deportations is at a record high, that is primarily border interceptions, not internal.
That's a lie.
That's not true?
That's absolutely not true. That's part of the sort of the Obama big machine of untruths. His first campaign of untruths was to say that everyone being deported were criminals. And we absolutely disprove that, and he's given up on that. The administration no longer goes around saying they're only deporting vicious felons, because right. It isn't true. Mm-hmm. And now they say they're only deporting people who are caught at the border. And that absolutely isn't true. Their statement, by the way, that it is very unlikely you'll be deported in the interior of the country, is laughably false. It's just laughably false, but it's their new political initiative.
Well, I know the head of La Raza came out and called him the deporter in chief. I think this was a couple of weeks ago.
That's true.
Any credit, or is it part of the, as you described it, Obama's big machine of untruths, this Dream Act light that we had, this deferred action?
When I said he buckled under pressure, that's where he buckled.
Okay.
He was running for re-election. The polls were showing that his level of Hispanic support was dropping. It began to plummet. And we all of us in politics know polls and know what they mean and know the inevitability of numbers if we don't change those trend lines. He had to change those trend lines, and that's how he did it. It worked. We're grateful. But now he's gone back to his old tricks. And the pressure.
You're interpreting this as basically political pandering. Is that your interpretation for the policy?
Absolutely. Look, I'm not suggesting that Obama or his instrument of evil, Janet Napolitano, were racist or anything of the sort. My point of view is this: that they're only going to throw as many Mexicans under the bus as they have to retain their political positions, and that's what they've done, and that's what they'll continue to do. And we will have to continue to maintain intense pressure on President Obama to at least have a balance between where we seek to go and where he's conceded to, that is, to the far right.
I want to move on, because we said we would do this, into the broadly how politics worked. And we go back to your years in the leadership in the 70s, in the 80s. There was a fellow, now has a library, Burton Barr, was the Republican mm-hmm. leader, was your compatriot. And basically, by every reckoning I've ever heard, you were able to work together and compromise and get things done. That seems not to happen anymore.
It certainly doesn't. Look, Bert was a confidant, a friend, a mentor. He was a brilliant legislator. And yes,
he was a Republican. You were a Democrat. In case
that's correct. He was a Republican, and I was a Democrat. I was the Democratic leader of the Senate for more than a dozen years, and he was the Republican leader of the House.
And widely regarded as the most powerful man in the state for a lot of that period.
Absolutely. We used to say that the House of Representatives was 59 members of the House surrounded by Burton Barr. Burt was a frenetic, extraordinary figure. But look, the difference was this. If you have a leadership, legislative and in the governor's office under Governor Babbitt, that has a vision for the future, that wants to build and construct, that wants to build freeways, for example, that wants to take the universities. You had to remember, Arizona State University was a second-rate institution in the early 70s. The University of Arizona was the better school, but it was a second-rate institution. It took an immense amount of money, creativity, dedication, and commitment to bring Arizona State University to the level that it is today, one of the greatest universities theoretically, or so they claim in the country, and the U of A that now claims to be the Harvard of the West. It took vision to do that.
Senator DeConcini was here within the last few weeks, and he said that some of the reason that politics doesn't work the way it did before is when they curtailed earmarks. Do you agree with that?
You're talking about federal politics primarily.
Well, obviously, his point was that you used earmarks to bring people along. It gave power to leadership. To get things done.
I think there's a great deal of truth to that. Look, most earmarks were used for public projects that benefited constituents. Most earmarks weren't put in suitcases and taken to Brazil so that legislators could enjoy a weekend. They were used for public policy efforts. But the fact is that when there was this great concern from the right over the rising cost of government, that became the first target. And it's unfortunate that it became the first target because, look, there are bridges in Safford that came about because of that. There's a light rail system in the city that came about because of that.
Real quick, let me tell you, because this is just too good. It's my favorite phrase in all of Arizona political lexicon. Tell us what shopping in Alfredo's store is.
Look, that was a phrase that was used. It was used by the press because the budget had to pass. There's one document that has to pass every legislative session, and that is the budget of the state of Arizona. You can't borrow in Arizona. There's no way around it. We either close down the state or you have to have a budget. Shopping at a store, Alfredo's store, meant that I controlled the budget. I controlled the votes for the budget. And that meant that if you wanted certain legislation included in the budget, it meant that we therefore could influence what went into the budget.
Nice. And that was back when you actually needed a Democratic vote in order to pass the budget.
Yeah, we're gonna get to more of that. We're up against a hard break, but we are back in just a few moments with Alfredo Gutierrez, his new book, A Sin Against Hope. More to come on The Think Tank right here on Newstalk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, Newstalk 92.3 KTAR.
We're talking to Alfredo Gutierrez, and one of the many roles he has held over the years is that he is currently a member of the board of the Maricopa Community College District. I want to ask you about kind of the philosophy of community colleges, and I've worked with them. We've done work for them. And there is one aspect in which I have just a little bit of ambivalence, and that's this. I think America is maybe almost unique in the world in terms of sort of believing in unlimited second chances, which at one level I think is wonderful. But I also look out into the high schools and I see a lot of evidence of kids in high school not taking it seriously. And I think of in some other cultures where education is taken more seriously early, in the Asian countries, for example, where you know you make it now or you don't ever get another chance. I love the second chance, but I hate the fact of kids knowing that that's out there, and so they don't, in many cases, I think, don't take the first chance seriously.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a point of view. The fact of the matter is that America's sort of primary and secondary education system was set up for an entirely different economy. I mean, I it was a time when a high school diploma was, if you chose it to be, a final step. It was a point of finality. You could go from there to the fabric, to manufacturing, a whole array of jobs, and be able to maintain a family of four, a family of five.
You could be middle class.
That's right. That's long gone. I mean, that doesn't exist any longer, but the system that was created to serve an economy that no longer exists, unfortunately, still exists. The fact is that high school should not be a final point. It should be part of a stream into community colleges and into colleges and universities in general. And that's writ large. I'm not suggesting that everyone needs an academic degree. I am suggesting the greater education that a high school diploma has become absolutely necessary. And the greatest provider of that is the community colleges. Look, at Arizona State University, where you are, 64% of the incoming class at Arizona State University has 12 or more community college classes. 12 or more community college credits, rather. It's pretty clear what's going on here. The community colleges have become the single greatest source of baccalaureate degrees and graduate degrees in this country. It is the gateway into education. Community colleges serve one other function. And in Maricopa, for example, we spend over $100 million in developmental education, what used to be called remedial education. Now, why would one do that?
Well, on the face of it, that says to me that those kids are not getting what they should have gotten in high school.
Absolutely. That's yes. What it says. It says they didn't get what they needed in high school. It says that having that high school diploma is insufficient for unfortunately, thousands of youngsters to be able to pass a college entrance examination. But look, their hopes and their ambitions shouldn't be dashed because the high school failed them. And so the developmental courses are intended to make sure that kids can be competitive and complete, reach their dreams, their dreams of a bachelor's degree, their dreams of any number of jobs. Look, a nuclear welder today is making a couple of $100,000. A welder.
A pretty good welder.
We're talking about a pretty high level of sophistication when we're talking nuclear welding. But nonetheless, there has to be a place where people get that sophisticated, technical, and difficult a craft, and it exists. The community colleges have been single sources, the largest source of nurses. So the colleges play an extraordinary role here. But keep this in mind. This is something that I think the universities, especially the administration at Arizona State University forgets. And that is they exist only. This great American university, as the new American university, as President Crowe likes to say, exists only because the bridge from high school to that great American university exists, and that's the community colleges. And so the colleges have to be taken in a very serious way. The other reality is this: the community colleges are. As much a force for social justice as they are for education. Overwhelmingly, the folks going into the system are folks who economically otherwise would not be entering the university. And so overwhelmingly, this is a force for social justice. This is a force for economic equality in this country. It's an important institution in this country.
The kids who come in a little bit short of college level, the ones who end up in remedial types of programs. How much of that do you think is the fault of the high schools, and how much of that is the fault of the kind of the messaging that kids are getting in the families about how important the education is?
I think all of that is true. I mean, I think the high school system is, as I said, one designed for an economy that doesn't exist any longer. Secondly, I think that the family, I think all of us, unfortunately, not all of us, but a substantial portion of our community is bought into this notion that a kid has to finish high school and somehow then it's over.
Yeah.
You know, then he can choose something else, but it's over. You know, he's completed his obligation or she's completed her obligation to society. And that just isn't so anymore. But I think the families have bought into that. The other reality is this, of course, and that is that kids from socioeconomic families that are low and struggling are probably not in a position to have the kind of leisure time with parents, et cetera, that envisions a graduate degree, a college degree. The reality is if you're struggling to pay the rent month to month, encouraging your son or daughter to go to college when you know you can't afford to help them is a difficult thing to do. Nonetheless, parents do it. There's 200 plus thousand people in the community college system because, in fact, parents keep doing it. They keep pushing people.
It happens. It happens a lot. I mean, we had one of the Dreamers on here a few months ago, and she's now a graduate student at Stanford. But I'm also, and I hate to do too much with anecdotes, but I remember some years ago, my daughter was in a mixed high school, and she came back kind of appalled. She wasn't like the most studious kid, but she said she was just appalled. She said, most of these kids are not doing any homework at all. And I said, how do you know that? She said, they're not bringing home any books. There's not any possibility they could be doing it. And that to me said that there's, and she was talking about a lot of kids.
Oh, absolutely.
I said, they're not taking this seriously.
Look, I think there's, it's certainly the society, certainly culture, certainly parents. But there's also this notion of expectation and this notion of, I'm particularly concerned with, I'll tell you, and that's this whole focus on what's now called STEM education, science, technology, math, et cetera. You know, for a lot of kids, that's just boring. You know, that ought to be music. Remember when there used to be? There used to be an equal focus on music,
on the arts. For that matter, civics.
Civics, philosophy, social science. There was a lot of intellectual ways that a youngster could become excited and excited to go to school. That is being limited day by day by day at most institutions. Now we have this Common Core. I'm not critical of the Common Core as some evil Washington plot. I'm critical.
I'm going to stop you there because I want to hear more about Common Core. Now you hit my dead center. I want to talk to you a little bit about Common Core when we come back. If you'd stick around with us after the break, I would appreciate that. Alfredo Gutierrez is here talking. We're talking politics, education, and his book To Sin Against Hope. More in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
All right, we're back with Alfredo Gutierrez, Arizona legend and author, To Sin Against Hope. Before the break, we mentioned Common Core. I've got two kids in school, kindergarten, third grade. This is hitting right into my bullseye. Would love your thoughts on Common Core. Bad, good, where do we go? Are we just doing something?
Well, I think the Common Core is it just carries on the notion that we've been going on since the George W. Bush administration, leaving no child left behind. This whole focus on three things. One is testing, is teaching children to the test. The other is limiting testing to a certain core level of subjects, and they are what otherwise is known as STEM, science, technology, English, and math. None of us doubt that those are exceedingly important subject matters today and for the future. No one would argue with that. The doubt is this, that's insufficient, that in order for youngsters, for your children, for everybody's children to be in school, you really need a wide variety of interests and stimulation. There's kids who that isn't going to be particularly exciting. It's going to be boring. They'd much more be interested in talking about a philosophy. They'd be more interested in talking about civics. They'd be more interested in talking about art, about theater. Those things that have been devalued in the current curriculum discussions and for the last two decades are what just one heck of a lot of youngsters found to be what stimulated them, the reason they went back to school. Mm-hmm. Those were the teachers that were interested in the subject matter that was interesting to them. And in the process, they had to learn everything else. But now we've thrown all of that out the door on this Common Core notion and this sort of, you know, competing with the Japanese notion that I think is ill-suited for American education and for the American psyche. I think we ought to go back to expanding the curricula rather than limiting the curricula. Oh,
okay. Right.
Now, let me ask about the testing thing. I mean, I share the concern about being too narrow and too high stakes and whatever, but I think from the public perspective, the appeal of testing is, well, if these educational systems are doing something, we ought to be able to measure it, right? There ought to be some level of test at some point that if you've learned something, you should be able to document, you should be able to retrieve. If you aren't able to retrieve and demonstrate it, you really don't have it.
Oh, I think that's accurate. The common, the catchphrase of educators today is metrics. That is measurement and the intent to measure every aspect of a student's academic career. I think it's accurate and appropriate to have accountability, to have measurement, and to have a very high expectation, not a low one. Kids shouldn't find it easy. They should find it increasingly more difficult, and they should be disciplined to be able to get to those increasingly more difficult points. So I have no problem with metrics. My problem is when you narrow it to a very, very narrow set of subjects, a set of material.
If we're only going to measure STEM, then we're devaluing everything else.
That's right, and we're making a conscious decision that those kids who aren't particularly interested in mathematics are to be set aside. They're going to be measuring as failures. Now, were they studying Shakespeare, they might be measuring as extraordinary successes. Were they putting on plays, they might be measuring extraordinary successes. Were they studying Picasso, you know, they might be quite different. If we were asking about Picasso's Blue Period in those exams, that's what we're missing. We're missing the intellectual life of a human being.
Now, one second. So as a father, I would ask this. So how does that help Picasso, how does Shakespeare, how does that help my kid compete in a global economy? That would be my first question.
Well, presumably it helps your son and daughter think and assess. Mm-hmm. Presumably it helps them think critically, be able to use language, discern language. Critical thinking is what we ought to be making the core of the system, ought to be critical thinking. And how we obtain that, whether it be through math or through Picasso, through Shakespeare, or through Samuel Beckett, doesn't matter. What matters is at the end of the day, your son or daughter have critical thinking capacity that allows them to go on and compete at any area of economics they wish to get into.
And what it seems to be happening, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this mathematics, and this is where it seems to be the big hang up for a lot of people, is the Common Core mathematics, where it seems to be teaching them critical thinking and linear thinking and things like that. So you're saying that they are trying to challenge them, they're just doing it in too narrow of a way.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that the kids should learn math, by the way. Please, if anybody's listening out there is taking that away, no. I'm suggesting that the options for how we reach youngsters have got to be much greater than what's contained in this current flavor of the day in education.
And I'll endorse that. Somebody used to teach at the college level. I mean, there are kids who you can see they learn how to. There's very little you can teach even at the college level that people are actually going to take out and apply, do that literally in their lives. If they did, by the time they graduate, that's gone. But if they learn how to adapt, how to think, how to process, that they will take with them, and you can learn. Mathematics does that. Philosophy does that as well. It's very precise thinking. There's a lot. If you teach mental discipline, you're going to take that with you for the rest of the
Absolutely.
Life. Today's technology will be tomorrow's technology. You know, that'll be yesterday's technology
Absolutely.
Tomorrow. I don't want to let you out of here, however, because I know you worked with Cesar Chavez personally.
I did.
And I know, use this as a segue. Cesar Chavez on education.
Well, I mean, Cesar was self-taught. He was an autodidact. He didn't go to school. He just was an extraordinary reader. I mean, he absorbed books. He was brilliant. Look, Caesar wasn't the saint this you know, we've sort of are making him out to
we
be
today. We sanitize all our heroes.
Yeah, Caesar was no saint. He was a tough guy. He was a radical. He was a leftist. He was a union organizer. He was tough.
And I do want to get into the other thing about him that I think may surprise a little, and I want you to talk about this, is Cesar Chavez on immigration.
Well, let me just talk about that, because Caesar had a period where the contracts that the unions had won, he felt were being threatened by the growers who were importing undocumented workers, illegal immigrants, quote unquote, from Mexico with the cahoots of the government. And he became, for a period of time, an outrageously offensive anti-immigrant, anti-Mexican immigrant specifically and particularly, advocate. He would, some of the uglier advocates today would find Caesar as an ally during that period. It was a horrendous mistake.
My inference that I draw about that is, if you're importing a lot of labor, you are undermining the labor movement.
That's exactly what his position was. Unfortunately, he adopted the worst language possible. He adopted the most offensive tactics possible. And frankly, that led to the demise of the union, because most of the organizers, most of the volunteers, most of the thousands of people who believed in him wouldn't believe that. I mean, we couldn't accept that. My family was deported. I couldn't continue to work with him at that point. I walked away, but I didn't walk away alone. Thousands of us left, and the union collapsed. I think it was a horrendous mistake, and I think he, to his last breath, regretted it. But that was unfortunately the truth.
We've got maybe a minute left. I want to leave. You're too erudite for me not to leave you the opportunity for a final thought.
Well, we talked a bit about education. That's really the final thought. That if we continue to cut budgets for public schools, and we continue to destroy the public school system, if we limit the sources of revenue for community colleges, if we take our university, we fought so hard to make them great universities, and literally abandon them economically, look, we're going to succeed in becoming a pretty dumb society, because we're taking specific dumb actions. And I use the word advisedly. That is the action that the legislature has taken today.
Well, Alfredo Gutierrez, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today. And please go out and get the book, To Sin Against Hope. Thank you for all that you're doing in the community colleges as well. We wish you continued success, and keep fighting the good fight for us.
Thank you very much.
On behalf of Dr. Mike O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell. Thanks for spending some time with us on your Sunday. Have a great week, everybody. This is The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.